This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Leaders from across the world are criticizing the haphazard global response to a microscopic virus that unleashed economic havoc and took nearly 1 million lives in its march across the globe. Kazakhstan's president has called it a critical collapse of global cooperation. The coronavirus pandemic and its consequences topped the list of concerns on the second day of pre-recorded speeches by world leaders Wednesday at the World's General Assembly's first virtual high-level meeting. Countries large and small spoke about struggling to deal with its impact without international coordination. Pleas for the world to work together to combat the scourge and other global problems have taken the forefront. During a news conference Wednesday evening, U.S. President Donald Trump said he may overrule the Food and Drug Administration on COVID-19 vaccine approval, claiming if they don't authorize the vaccine, politics might be the reason. Meanwhile, earlier in the day, the head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said science will guide our decisions as the agency decides whether to give full or emergency authorization to a coronavirus vaccine. Dr. Stephen Hahn was speaking to the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Hahn said the decisions will be made by career FDA scientists and pledged the approval process will be transparent and independent. The United States is moving forward with a plan to manufacture doses of some of the vaccine candidates currently undergoing trials. This is so doses can be made available to the public quickly if and when they are, in fact, approved. This is VOA News. After a Kentucky grand jury brought no charges against Louisville police for Breonna Taylor's death, protesters took to the streets. Authorities said two officers were shot and wounded Wednesday night during the demonstrations expressing anger over the killings of black people at the hands of police. Interim Louisville Police Chief Robert Schroeder said in a statement, a suspect is in custody, but did not offer details about whether that person was participating in the demonstrations. He says that both officers are expected to recover and one is undergoing surgery. The violence comes after prosecutors said two officers who fired their weapons at Taylor, a black woman, were justified in using force to protect themselves after they said they faced gunfire from her boyfriend. The only charges were three counts of wanton endangerment against fired officer Brett Hackinson, for shooting into a home next to Taylor with people inside. The FBI is still investigating potential violations of federal law in connection with the raid at Taylor's home on March 13th. After the announcement, demonstrators also marched in cities like New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, and Philadelphia. Along with the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota, Taylor's case became a major touchstone for nationwide protests that have drawn attention to entrenched racism and demanded police reform. The United States on Wednesday announced new sanctions against Cuba aimed at further denying sources of revenue to the government in Havana. President Trump says his administration stands with the Cuban people, not the government. At a ceremony recognizing veterans of the Bay of Pigs invasion, Mr. Trump says that he is tightening the restrictions against Cuba to financially starve the island's government. Two Republican-led Senate committees have released a report on Hunter Biden's work in Ukraine, and Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has assumed his sixth term in office. An inauguration ceremony that officials did not announce in advance was held Wednesday. State news agency Belcher reported that the swearing-in ceremony took place in the Capitol with several hundred government officials, lawmakers, and media representatives present, and comes after weeks of mass protest against the official results of the August 9th election that resulted in Lukashenko's reelection. Lukashenko said it was a day of our victory, convincing and fateful. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 24th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambian police summon an opposition leader over allegations of election rigging.
We have no idea why the police have gotten involved. I guess they are trying to criminalize my whistleblowing of just the fact that we do have information that the election that just ended was rigged.
A new party has been added to Zimbabwe's more than 100 political parties. Gambia's main opposition leader criticizes parliament for rejecting a draft constitution. We'll have analysis and a conversation with a young author of a new book, Uganda Without Museveni.
It is not a story about Nelson Ngwenya alone. It's a story about many Ugandans who have gone to school and they cannot get jobs.
Cameroon says patients are at risk as COVID-19 scares away blood donors. And a South African father and daughter singing duo has gone viral in Colombia. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Zambian opposition leader said he thinks Zambian police are trying to criminalize his whistleblowing on election rigging in Zambia. The police on Wednesday gave Nevos Momba, leader of the New Hope Movement for Multi-Party Democracy, 1 hour to report himself to police headquarters for questioning. He had claimed that the ruling Patriotic Front Party rigged recent local elections. He also said the ruling party recruited a South African IT guru to help rig the 2021 presidential election. The ruling PF party had said it would take Momba to court to prove his allegations. Momba says the police involvement is suspicious.
Well, first of all, yes, I would like to confirm that my office received a call out from the police at 1 o'clock and, at 1:30 p.m. And they wanted me to report at the central police or at the headquarters of the police within an hour. Obviously, I have not been around. I'm in out of town in mobilization, so I was not able to make it for that appointment. My office did contact me, and I told them that I would make myself available by Monday in the morning when I'm back in Lusaka.
Mr. Momba, the ruling Patriotic Front Party had first threatened to take you to court to prove your initial allegations. Now, why do you think they got the police involved?
Well, it's very strange. It's very, very strange. We have no idea why the police have gotten involved. I guess they are trying to criminalize my whistleblowing of just the fact that we do have information that the election that just ended was rigged. And we have the evidence for it. I also mentioned that we are also aware that there is a facility that has been set up that is supposed to be used to, you know, rig the elections next year. And it's important that all the stakeholders be on a lookout to ensure that any threat to a clean election next year is removed so that there is equitable participation by all stakeholders. So I am committed to ensuring that I continue to challenge the Electoral Commission of Zambia to ensure that there is transparency in the system of electing the president, members of parliament, and councillors next year. So that is really my position. I want good governance, I want transparency, and I also want to make sure that anyone who is trying to obstruct the vote, you know, is exposed in good time.
Now, Mr. Momba, to the allegations that sparked the whole thing, you had alleged that the Patriotic Front rigged a local by-election and that they recruited a South African guru to help them rig the 2021 elections. Do you have proof to back up your allegations or your claims?
Yes, I do have proof, but at the end of the day, what we do as whistleblowers is that when you raise an issue, it's up to them, the police themselves. They have information to use to investigate that. And we do have the information. And I'm saying if they decide to commit me to court, then I will lay that information on the table.
Are you supposed to appear before the police again, or this is all?
I haven't appeared before the police yet. I'm going to appear before the police on Monday at 10 in the morning.
We thank you so much again for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, and have a good one.
Nevers Mamba is president of the opposition New Hope Movement for Multi-Party Democracy of Zambia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwe has a new political party added to the already more than 100 political parties in the country. It is called the Generational Economic Transformers, or GET Party. James Mapande, vice president of the new party, says the philosophy is economic reform first before elections.
Generational Economic is a party which is a people-centered party. What we mean by that is that we want to fight for the rights of all Zimbabweans. We want to make sure that there won't be any elections in Zimbabwe without reforms. Because what we have seen is that the main difference between the Generational Economic Transformers compared to the MGC, which is in existence, is that the MGC would go to elections. They are in parliament. They have got seats in parliament. They wait until the elections come. Then they would want to say, we want reforms through the marching in the streets. That is not how we do things. If ever we are in parliament, we would start fighting for reforms in parliament. We are going to tell all the people of Zimbabwe to say, let us go and fight for reforms. Once the reforms are in place, then we can all go to the vote. And once we go to the vote with reforms, then we are going to vote and every voter will have a say.
Currently, Zimbabwe has a lot of problems. Some people say economic, some people say political. Do you think the solution to some of these problems right now in Zimbabwe is more political parties?
Remember, in Zimbabwe, we have got more than 150 political parties. The problem in Zimbabwe is both political and economical. So when we speak of the politics and the economy, we're speaking of one thing that needs to be addressed. So immediately when we address the issue of politics, then the economic will then start running smoothly. The people who are presiding over the economy are the politicians. So once the political environment is settled through the political reforms that we would want to advocate for as Generational Economic Transformers, I'm 100% sure that the economy will run smooth. Let us look at the economic side. The economy is now going down, deteriorating every day. Why? Because there is a fight between the political parties. There is a fight between the executive. There is a fight between the legislature. There is a fight between the judiciary. So all those branches are the ones which are causing the economy to downgrade each and every day.
I'm assuming that the leaders of this new party are all Zimbabweans. I'm wondering, why are you announcing the formation of your new party in South Africa and not in Zimbabwe?
For us to be in South Africa is not because of choice. It is because of the economic deterioration that has gone down since early 2000, going to 2008, whereby there was a skyrocket of inflation. That's where more Zimbabweans started fleeing to South Africa, Botswana, and other nearest countries across the Zimbabwean borders. So for us to form this, we sit down and say, we cannot say we die here in South Africa. We cannot say that we are well here in South Africa, trying to find peace jobs here and there and work. But people whom we left in Zimbabwe are still suffering. It is now time for us as Zimbabweans to sit down and think and put something down. That's where we sat down as the leaders of Generational Economic Transformers and put the 12 non-negotiable cardinal pillars. Then we said, these are the ones which we are going to go back to Zimbabwe with and start fighting for them to be realized.
James Mapande is the vice president of the newly formed Generational Economic Transformers Party of Zimbabwe. He was speaking with us from South Africa. In Uganda, the author of a new book says the country's youth should move away from indifference to actively fight against oppression. Nelson Mkwene is the author of the new book entitled Uganda Without Museveni, Museveni's Quest for Power, Who Pays the Price? The book was launched this week by four-time presidential candidate Dr. Chisa Besigye. Mkwene explains why he wrote the book.
I was born in 1989, and I found Mr. Museveni a president And as I've gone up to university, my parents selling all the property we have at home and sending me to school. After graduating with a university degree, it has taken me now 6 years with no job. So I write this story. It is not a story about Nelson Nkwene alone. It's a story about many Ugandans who have gone to school and they cannot get jobs, who cannot get medical care, who dehumanized and bullied and beaten on streets whenever they try to express their opinion to do with the dictatorship of Mr. Museveni is concerned. And so I wrote this book that gives fellow Ugandans, fellow discontented Ugandans, an understanding of who Mr. Museveni is.
Now, four-time presidential candidate Dr. Chisa Besigye launched your book this week. What does this mean to you as a young author?
Dr. Chisa Besigye is an icon and the founder and the father of the struggle against the dictatorship of Mr. Museveni. So he means a lot. He's symbolic. His presence on the launch of my book, it sends a big signal to fellow discontented Ugandans that it is the book that if really Ugandans want to liberate themselves, indeed they need to give attention, and it is a tool that they need if we are to liberate our country from the fangs of Museveni dictatorship.
Ugandans will vote in presidential election next year. How do you think your book fit into the whole scheme of Ugandan politics?
My brother James, the Ugandan politics as we talk of now, the president we have, Mr. Museveni, he clearly puts to us that for him is like a kotapini. If I may explain to you what a kotapini is, it's the part of the body of a bicycle. It can only be put by a hammer and can only be removed by a hammer. So I do not have lots of expectations in the next year elections. Mr. Museveni cannot be removed by elections. Ugandans need a collective action model to act as citizens and do away with Museveni.
Dr. Besigye said in launching your book that Ugandans need to move away from indifference to active discontent and actively fight oppression. Do you share these views?
Actually, my book is a call to fellow Ugandans to move away from indifference towards active discontent in the struggle against dictatorship of Mr. Museveni.
Any particular message for young would-be Ugandan authors or for the young people of Uganda in general?
My message goes to fellow Ugandans, more especially the youth, that fellow Ugandans, we need not be manipulated anymore by Mr. Museveni and his cronies and NRM. We need the change that is going to give us our political rights, where everyone is going to grow full potential, irrespective of where we are born, irrespective of our ethnic background, irrespective of our religion.
Thank you very much again, Nelson. It's so nice to talk with you.
Thank you, my brother James.
Nelson Nkwene is the author of the new book entitled Uganda Without Museveni, Museveni's Quest for Power, Who Pays the Price? He was speaking with us from Kampala. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 24th. Gambia's main opposition leader, Useinu Dabo, says the parliament's rejection yesterday of the country's draft constitution was a dark day for democracy. The new constitution, when passed, would have limited presidential terms to 2 terms. Allies of former President Yahya Jammeh and current President Adama Barrow voted against the draft constitution. Madi Jobate is a Gambian human rights defender. He spoke to Ricky Stryag about why certain assembly members voted against the draft constitution.
The draft constitution now is effectively dead because the constitution requires that in both the second and the third readings, it should obtain 3/4 of the members of the National Assembly. Since it didn't get that, then it means there's no point for it to even go to the third reading because, it doesn't have the required, level that the constitution requires it to have.
What are the discussions around the idea of putting 2-term limits in the constitution? Who's for and who's against this and why?
Generally, all assembly members agree to the idea of a term limit. The concern has been that the term should begin in 2017, and So those who are opposed to the idea, therefore, are opposed to it because of that. In their argument, the term should start in 2021 because for them, starting in 2017 denies or deprives the current President Barrow of two terms. So they didn't agree that the term, the first term of President Barrow, which is 2017 to 2021, should count. And so that is what they are opposed to. And so a lot of them voted against it, basically just because of that.
I understand the supporters of Jammeh voted against the draft constitution, as well as the National Reconciliation Party, which is one of Barrow's closest allies. Why do you think that is?
APRC voted against the draft constitution because what they claim is not in the interest of the people. But clearly, what I could figure out is the fact that APRC feels beholden to Jammeh, because this 1997 constitution was drawn up during Jammeh's time. Voting against or for the draft constitution to replace the 1997 constitution would be considered by them to be opposing something of Jammeh's legacy. But also the fact that APRC has taken a position that, in to a large extent, do not seem to support any move towards bringing about accountability or good governance or strengthening democracy beyond what obtains, especially under Jammeh. NRP, certainly, their party leader is the Minister of Justice, Hamad Ba, who has expressed his intention, his willingness to have even Barrow stand for the presidential candidate of his party. So he's given his party to Barrow's support a long time ago. So it's not far-fetched that they went ahead to vote against this draft constitution. And so naturally they would vote against this just to secure the interests of Barrow, which is that the draft constitution doesn't favor him in terms of the fact that it sets a term limit in 2017 instead of 2020 or 2021.
That was Madi Jobate, Gambia representative for the Westminster Foundation for Democracy. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Banjul. Cameroon says it urgently needs more than 2,000 pints of blood to save the lives of about 300 people, including hemodialysis patients, in the Central African state's troubled English-speaking town of Bamenda. Health workers say the fear of COVID-19, coupled with increasing attacks by separatist fighters, has scared away most blood donors. People wounded in the separatist crisis and dialysis patients are being rushed to hospitals in French-speaking towns. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
...55-year-old Ngum Siri is being rushed to the general hospital in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, in the hospital's ambulance. The hemodialysis patient was brought in from the English-speaking town of Bamenda by her family members. She says she is in search of blood to save her life.
When you give blood, you save life. So we are pleading with the population to help us donate blood in the general hospital. There are vulnerable people in the hospital who need blood, like those in dialysis, those with sickle cell, and we have blood shortage in the hospital.
Siri is one of the 30 patients from the English-speaking northwestern town of Bamenda who have received emergency assistance at the general hospital within the past 6 days. Fidelis Ako, head of the blood transfusion unit of the regional hospital in Bamenda, confirms that patients are leaving for French-speaking towns. He says blood banks are becoming empty in English-speaking towns. He says the separatist conflict led many blood donors to escape to safer localities, and blood scarcity became acute with COVID-19 scare.
The socio-political crisis has scared many of our donors away, and then now the COVID-19. And so since the hospital is a treatment center, many people think that when you come here, you have coronavirus, and so we could not have persons coming to the hospital to donate blood as well. We could not organize mobile voluntary blood donation campaign.
People should not be afraid of coming to the hospital to make their blood donation, because coronavirus is not injectable.
Akko says the blood bank of the Bamenda Hospital has not been able to help 40 patients in need within 7 days.
Last week, we received over 70 requests for blood units, but we've been able to transfuse just 31 units of blood. Before the crisis, we were transfusing over 4,000 units of blood per year. But as of now, we have not been able to transfuse up to 2,000 units. So it shows that we are going to lose more patients because we don't have blood units available in the blood bank.
Cameroon said several patients have died as a result of the blood shortage and that its hospitals are finding it difficult to treat civilians wounded in the separatist conflicts. Many of the injured are moved to hospitals in French-speaking towns like Bafoussam, Douala and Yaoundé. Akko said health authorities last week announced incentives to encourage blood donation. Civilians who donate blood will have a 50% reduction in their medical bills when they become sick. Non-governmental organizations have been encouraging people to donate blood. Theka Parshibel of the NGO Hope for Vulnerables and Orphans says many children they help also need blood.
Our people are in dire need of blood. I am calling on all blood donors in the Northwest and Southwest regions to help by rushing to the hospitals to donate blood to save lives. All we need is to practice all the preventive measures.
Cameroon has reported more than 20,000 COVID-19 cases with 415 deaths since March 5, when the first coronavirus case was reported in the Central African state, according to Johns Hopkins University data. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A South African father and daughter singing duo that gained attention in Britain for their singing talent has gone viral in Colombia after being mistakenly identified as relatives of a famous Italian opera singer. Franco Puglisi reports from Johannesburg.
During South Africa COVID-19 lockdown, 11-year-old Emma Jean Galliard and her 46-year-old father, Adrian, began posting their singing online to pass the time. They recorded duets performed by Italian opera singer Andrea Bocelli with British soprano Sarah Brightman in Canada's Celine Dion. The bubbly little Emma has more to say.
We thought we would let out this amazing song called The Prayer, and it just went viral, and we didn't actually expect any of it, and it was a really big surprise, and we really loved it.
Father and daughter never expected such an avalanche of views in such a short time. The video was picked up by the British website The Music Man and watched by millions. Tom Bainbridge has the details.
Within 2 weeks, it received over 7 million views. It's a really good video, so we wrote an article about it on themusicman.uk, which is our website. And then quickly we started seeing people coming from Google, coming from Instagram, coming from Twitter, sharing and leaving comments about how good they are and the song and how much they love it.
Hits kept coming, for one of the duo's online videos was picked up in South America. They didn't think they were doing anything differently, Adrian says.
It was astounding. It was absolutely crazy because, we put these songs out and we, in the hope that people enjoy them, and a lot of people really do, but to get those numbers, and we got those numbers within a few days. So it was, within a few days, we'd had 16 million views. So it's quite surreal, the whole experience, because you don't see yourself as doing anything different, and yet suddenly you've got these fans and comments, thousands and thousands of comments from people all over the world.
But much of the fame came from a Colombian Facebook page, which claimed wrongly they were opera singer Bocelli's son and granddaughter. The mistake brought welcome attention to the duo's singing back home in South Africa. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will have a great day.